Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle. This program is made possible today by Public Utilities Fortnightly, the 100-year-old magazine serving the electric utility industry. At present, they are building a conference which will take place in Scottsdale, Arizona, on the 17th and 18th of November to look at the disruptive technologies that are changing the nature of the electric utility industry and the electricity that comes to your home. You can find out more at their website, Public Utilities Fortnightly. Things are changing in every possible way. And we tend to think the great revolution is telecommunications and computers, but it's also materials. You know, there are some problems which are so vast that there are no simple solutions, until they're so big that a simple solution wipes them all away. This may be the case when it comes to global warming. We may move to means of transportation and generating electricity that really don't put any, that doesn't put any hydrocarbons into the air. The electric car, long the orphan of the car industry, because the lead acid batteries, the batteries you and I have in our cars were no good. But now batteries are getting better. But more important, the way of charging electric cars is getting better. It is possible at some time in the future that you will get your car charged while you're stopped to the stoplight. Think of that. Electric automobiles, electric buses, electric trucks. No pollution problem from transportation. Depends how you're making the electricity, of course. And if you're doing it with nuclear, solar, and wind, you're doing a pretty good job of not polluting. What is the big change? I believe it to be something called induction charging. It's an old idea, but now it's been perfected in South Korea, where buses are charging when they go to pick up passengers at the bus stop. So the batteries are smaller, the vehicles are lighter, and everybody is, it seems, in a win-win. But it's early days. Keep tuned. Linda Gasparello, the co-host of this program, is going to introduce our two exceptional guests.
We are delighted to welcome to the program Stephen Kinzer, who worked for the New York Times for more than 20 years, and most of the time is a foreign correspondent. He's the author of some great foreign policy books. His latest is about the John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles. It's called The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, and Their Secret World War. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe and a senior fellow at the in International and Public Affairs at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. And I'd like to welcome Jim Lutis, who is Executive Director at the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, you have told me that you admire a television show where they're rude to the guests. should I try?
Sure.
Between the two of you, you follow foreign policy very closely, and it's deteriorating in the Middle East almost daily because nobody seems to have a good idea. We've got Russia in there in a very aggressive way in Syria. How do you read the situation? Do you have any idea what this administration, the Obama administration, should do to get us out or to get peace?
Well, in the first place, when it comes to Syria, our policy now is that everybody is our enemy. We have no friends, so we are against the Assad government, we're against Iran, we're against Russia, we're against ISIS, we're against Nusra, which is the Al-Qaeda group. We're against everybody. So our strategic goals are very unclear, and it's a principle of international relations that when you don't know what your strategic goals are, you're certainly not going to reach them. What we ought to realize is that if we don't want to fantasize about an outcome there, there are really only three players. There are three big forces there. There's the Assad government, there's Al-Qaeda, which calls itself Nusra Front, and then there's ISIS. One of the three of those is going to emerge victorious if anybody does. So our strategy ought to be to think, out of those three, we have to pick somebody we'd like to be for. We don't want to do that because we feel all of them have their reasons why we shouldn't like them. But in the real world, if we want to get somewhere, we first have to figure out what the destination is. And we haven't even gotten to that point yet.
Jim, what's your read?
I think that Steve is diagnosed it pretty well. It's It's a strange day when you listen to sort of the critique from Russian President Vladimir Putin, and you go, oh, some of that made a little sense. And his critique is essentially that if the West, if the community of nations is going to pick a winner in Syria, there's no choice other than Assad. I'm not sure I'm ready to go there, but I don't think that there are a lot of other really good alternatives.
Well, look at the other examples we have. In Iraq and in Libya, we saw a repressive dictator that we didn't like because he was brutalizing his people. So we decided, wouldn't it be wonderful to get rid of that person? And we did. We got rid of Saddam Hussein. We got rid of Gaddafi. Now, instead of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, we have 100 Saddam Husseins. And Libya has splintered into a chaotic state that is a festering breeding ground for terrorism. What it means is you shouldn't destroy a regime you don't like unless you know what's coming afterward. We feed ourselves this fantasy that Thomas Jefferson is waiting out there, and as soon as we get rid of, in the case of Syria, Assad, the school teachers and the pharmacists will come together in a town meeting and we'll have something like the Continental Congress and everything will be like Switzerland. But these countries do not have the basis for democracy, and once you remove the stabilizing force of that repressive leader and get rid of what you might call repressive stability, you wind up with violent, murderous chaos. Neither one is appealing, but when you have to choose between unappealing options, you have to pick the one that's the least unappealing.
Isn't that, Steve, what the Russian argument basically is for keeping Assad in power? It's the idea that, you know, he may be a bastard, but he's the bastard that can keep everything together in Syria right now, including being able to defeat the terrorists, ISIS.
I'd say yes, and I think the Americans should be grateful to Putin for what he's doing for two reasons. First of all, in the short run, I think he's the force that's going out there and trying to protect the best of the bad options, which is the Assad government. If that government falls, there will be huge massacres of Christians and Druze and Alevis. So he's doing a job that is distasteful, but somebody needs to do. But I'll tell you another thing that I think we should be grateful to Putin for doing. So after the Second World War, the United States decided that with Britain moving out of the Middle East and Britain no longer being the target of the hatred of hundreds of millions of people in that region, we should move in. And sure enough, over the last 70 years, we've become the target of huge hatred in that part of the world because we've been trying to manipulate governments and peoples all over that region. Now we're slowly moving out, and Putin and Russia will now become the target of all that hatred. So it's the way that we can finally wash our hands of some of it.
I think that would be, I hope you're right. Let me put it that way. I think, though, that you have to take a look at just sort of what has Russia really committed to Syria. We're talking about 24 planes, a couple of hundred troops. There are reports that there may be a couple of maybe 600 ground troops, volunteers, Putin says, that are headed there as well. But if you look at what America and its coalition, all external coalition partners, but coalition partners have done in the last year plus, you're talking about 57,000 sorties, more than 8,000 targets that have been hit. If the Russians only commit 24 aircraft to that, you're talking a long time before they catch
you're
up to that level of destruction.
You're making the case against bombing as being a very inefficient, although it creates enormous hostility and tremendous suffering. I remember when, in England, when long after the Second World War, but when the memory of the bombing in London was still very acute, if a car backfired, somebody I knew dived under a table. It was the reaction. She had been a small child and had been trained to, and it was her instinctive thing. The effect of bombing is terrible. Right. But it's not conclusive.
It's not. It's
People
not.
Don't come rushing to the treaty table because bombs are falling.
Well, the bigger point that I wanted to make.
What they do is they leave Syria and go to Europe.
Well, that's right.
Would
that's
add
right.
a fourth dimension to Steve's three very articulate issues, which is when you've got all these people in Europe, that becomes a force.
It certainly does. The bigger point that I wanted to make about Russian involvement in Syria, though, is that I think that this is, I think that the touch point that we should remember is the Pristina airport in the Kosovo campaign, where with NATO forces closing the noose around Serbia, Russia hopped a red line and drove some armored units to the airport in Pristina and said, "We're here." And it gave them a negotiating position that was better than it would have been if they weren't there.
I'd also agree with you that the Russian presence there is principally symbolic. In the United States, we're building this up because we want to find somebody to blame, and we're in this big anti-Russia mode. So we're seeing this as proof of Russia's spreading strategic power, which is actually kind of a fantasy, as Russia is kind of a hollowed-out, collapsing state. But in our lust for an enemy all the time, we've now focused back on one that we were just dusting off from a few decades ago, and we've got Russia there. So we're using this more to get ourselves agitated. And on the ground, it's not making that much difference.
Well, I think, you know, on the ground, it's also going to help us in another way, which is a more indirect way. The more Russia gets involved in Syria, and this sounds very cynical, but the less they're going to be involved in Ukraine and other parts of Eastern Europe, because they're going to have to pull troops that know what they're doing out of those areas to come down and fight in Syria. And apparently, that's what they're doing right now. They're taking troops out of Ukraine. They're taking troops out, you know, Russian sympathizers in Chechnya, out of Chechnya and down into Syria. They're going to be providing housing for them. And they're going to put a few boots on the ground. I'm not saying a massive, you know, massive army, but they are going to be putting these troops on the ground that otherwise might be menacing other areas that would certainly give NATO cause for concern.
Well, you could certainly argue that the so-called Russian intervention in Syria, even at this modest level, is a bigger story for Russia. It means more for Russia than it does for Syria.
For
it doesn't mean much for Syria, but it means a lot for us because it sets us into a panic, and it leads us to build up Russia in a way that Russia wants to be built up.
It is true. And there is no way that Putin is going to be able to restore Bashar al-Assad in the way that he was the leader of Syria before all of this happened. He only controls a very small part of Syria right now, and it's just not going to go back to the way things were with Russian support. It just isn't. There isn't that much territory for him.
Syria is finished. Failed state. There is no Syria
That's right.
As a functioning country to be resuscitated.
This is what happens when you behead a regime or try to behead it without thinking about what comes next. And, you know, I give you a great comparison between what happened in Syria and what happened in Iran. So you remember that in 2009 we had the Green Movement protests in Iran. Millions of people went out onto the streets to protest the stolen election, and they were brutally repressed. How did the Iranians respond? Well, they decided, oh, they're beating us. They're not going to let us have what we want. We better go home and wait for this to take its own shape, and we're going to get what we want some other time. The Iranians learned a real painful lesson in 1979, which was revolution also can produce what's worse than what you had before. And so they realized, okay, it's not worth destroying the country. Let's just go home and let's agree that we surrender to the brutality of our regime. 2 years later, the same thing happened in Syria. Syrians rose up. They were also beaten. And they decided, we're getting guns. We're going to take this out onto the battlefield. And look at Iran today, which is an island of stability in the Middle East, and look at the chaos in Syria. It teaches you a great lesson about patience and waiting for history to take its course.
And I think it also ought to be a lesson to American policymakers, because the rhetorical position of the Obama administration in the midst of the Green Revolution was roundly criticized, particularly by the right, as turning our backs on the people in the streets of Tehran who are confronting the Ayatollah. And in Syria, the American rhetorical position was much more aggressive, much more forward-leaning, called for Assad's departure, drew a red line, and then didn't enforce it. And it's sort of part and parcel of this bipartisan interventionism that has bedeviled us for a generation.
Excuse me a moment, Steve. We're going to take a few moments for station identification. This is primarily for the benefit of our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, channel 124, the POTUS channel. You are listening to White House Chronicle with myself, Llewellyn King, Linda Gasparello, co-host of this program, Stephen Kinzer, who is a columnist for the Boston Globe and is a longtime foreign correspondent of the New York Times, and now also lectures at Brown University. And our friend on this program, a frequent guest, Jim Ludis, is Executive Director of the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University. This program can be seen on 200 American television screens and around the world on the English language stations of The Voice of America. Jim, most in recent years, we've seen in foreign policy, usually a strong person or perceived to be strong person, usually in the White House, in the person of the advisor, National Security Advisor. Yeah. Do we have a strong person either in the State Department or in the White House?
Well, you know, I have a lot of friends who are working in the White House and the State Department. I have tremendous respect and great confidence in both Susan Rice and Secretary Kerry. They are both dedicated public servants. They're both tremendously smart.
But the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and the pudding is in not very edible. Don't we have a total collapse of our foreign policy ability, bad advice, and it also extends and should probably show up in an election of Mrs. Clinton,
yeah.
Who was... Secretary, when many of these things started going wrong.
Yeah, I am...
Because they're your friends doesn't make them blameless.
No, and I've been pretty candid and public in my criticisms.
By the way,
of the,
Susan Rice used to be a regular on this program.
I understand that. I think that there's a lot that the Obama administration ought to be held accountable for in terms of what's happened in the world on their watch. A lot of these are forces that are entirely beyond their control, but I would be the first to tell you that their response has often been lacking.
I think it's beyond their control. It's beyond their comprehension. What would you say, Steve?
I think President Obama has changed his views a little bit as the administration has taken its course. At the beginning, we had this disastrous intervention in Libya, which was driven by the humanitarian interventionists like Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power. That was such a disaster that I think it's led Obama to reassess and to realize that there are some places where it's better to do nothing. It calls to mind that story of Sherlock Holmes, the Hound of the Baskervilles. You remember it was solved because Sherlock Holmes thought of the dog that did not bark.
That's right.
Sometimes not barking is a wiser policy than trying to go after and bite someone.
I think that not barking policy has really been what has happened in Syria. You know, you can look at the way John McCain had been arguing forcefully for our getting involved with what Vladimir Putin calls the shadow rebels.
John McCain's advice, we wouldn't have any soldiers to get involved in Syria because they'd all be fighting in Georgia, in Ukraine. We'd be at war everywhere in the world
if we followed that
policy.
But this is where...
With intellectual input from the Weekly Standard.
This is where Obama's hands-off policy and wait and see actually did yield us a result that was a lot better than if we had followed the hotheads. But, you know, you wonder about the deterioration with Russia. We started off pretty well with Russia. We started off with Russia trying to help us in Syria get rid of the chemical weapons. We can remember that. They said, look, we can make sure that these chemical weapons get out of Syria. We'll take them. We'll help you along with that. Just recently, when things looked like we were converging on all the great powers were thinking about ISIS and the need to remove ISIS from the area, the Russians were getting on board with that. They were working. They had many meetings in Moscow with all partners at the table, whether it was Gulf Arabs or whether it was Iran or whether it was Syrians themselves, on what to do about this menacing threat of ISIS. And yet, there was this intractable position on our part that Assad would not be part of a transition government. And Russia very realistically said, he is the guy that you need to get you over the hump. Then we can talk about getting rid of him. But we need to maintain the status quo. We need him to be the guy. We need to back him in order to get rid of these other bad guys?
Well, I would say that if the worst foreign policy decision Obama ever made was decapitating Libya, the second right. worst was to say Assad must go.
Right.
And not only that, but it became our policy that when we convene negotiations to try to resolve the crisis in Syria, the only people allowed into the room, the only ones allowed at the table, were those who had already said, Assad has to go, no more discussion. With that, you decide you're only going to negotiate with your friends, and you can never solve a war that way.
Well, I think that was the Russian point. That was Sergei Lavrov's point, the foreign minister of Russia, that you can't begin the negotiations that way. We have to look realistically at what is there.
Now, well, that's right. So history tells you, you've got to at some point sit down with people you don't like.
Right.
I went through...
And Russia has sat down with...
I went to the end of the British Empire and other empires in Africa. In the end, you sat down with the people you had imprisoned or you were fighting against, whether it was in Kenya or Zimbabwe.
Now,
or,
again, that serves an interest of Vladimir Putin, who certainly does not want to see terrorists challenge his rule.
Well, but let's look at some other things here. We're not just talking about Syria when we're talking about chaos. We've got chaos next all over the Middle East. We've got chaos in Iraq. We've got chaos in Afghanistan. There's no shortage of places that are disintegrating.
Well, I think Putin says to the Russians, who are not really for this intervention, that I may not be the most democratic guy, but wouldn't you rather have what I've got than chaos? You know, and that's...
Well, I would add another point, that as Russia has tried to play a bigger role in the world, the United States has reacted and painted Russia as an enemy. And from Russia, it looks as though we're trying to surround that country with these color revolutions and ultimately bring those to Moscow. So I think that Russia now is realizing that the role for it to play in the world is to be a little bit more realistic about
yes.
the world, not to look at the world as the fantasy world, but to deal with the real world.
And it's for us to realize that Russia is no longer the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, we haven't realized that.
We haven't, particularly the right
way. I'm saying it is for us to realize that, and we haven't.
A few moments ago, I asked Jim about the foreign policy establishment in Washington, particularly in the administration. Often we've had a very dominating person. Kissinger was the most dominating of all, but do we lack that person now?
I don't think it's a question of individuals. To me, I go to Washington as rarely as possible, but whenever I do, I'm struck with how narrow is the spectrum of acceptable opinions on foreign policy. In order to be admitted into a serious discussion of what the United States should do, you have to accept dozens of assumptions about the value of military power and the absolute necessity of the yeah. indispensable United States crashing into other countries. The fact is, many of these countries are going through processes that we cannot shape. They have to go through this. Religion kept Europe in the Dark Ages for 1,000 years. I hope it won't last 1,000 years in the Middle East. But these people have to work out some of these issues, and every problem in the world does not require the United States to come over and try to fix it. That's a difficult thing for some Americans, particularly in Washington, to grasp, because it implies recognizing a limit on American power, and that's something that is an assumption you cannot bring into the negotiating room in Washington.
I do think that there is, to your question, Llewellyn, there is a fundamental shift in the way the administration is organized. The concentration of power and authority and responsibility in the NSC and in the White House itself is really a fundamental change from what we saw when the Dulles boys were running things in D.C. It has concentrated authority with those staff officers in the NSC. And it has made the ability to have real policy innovation come up through the professionals and the agencies and in the departments a real challenge.
Foreign policy innovation in Washington is almost an oxymoron.
Yeah.
We do not have innovation in foreign policy. We have great policies to deal with the world that doesn't exist anymore, but we don't have policies for the world that exists now.
I'd say so.
What is the beginning of the fix? What do we do?
Well, I think part of it is the elections are going to change the composition of the staff at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, no matter who wins.
No matter.
But I think more fundamentally, I think Steve has made a really eloquent case here today for this orthodoxy in D.C. thinking on foreign policy. You've got the neocons on the right. You've got the progressive internationalists on the left. They all agree on the interposition of American military power to solve all manner of problems in the world.
And
breaking
they also,
that grip.
May I add something else it seems to me they agree on, and that is that it's America's fault.
I don't know if they agree that it's America's fault, but it's America's responsibility
to
solve.
From the right, it's, we haven't intervened enough. From the left, we set up a series of things that produce this.
Or we weren't true to our values or whatever. But breaking that grip on foreign policy thinking, and frankly, the people who will get jobs in the next administration, if they come from either of those two camps, nothing's going to change.
And they certainly will. The next president will definitely be more interventionist than what we have now. And that's going to lead us into more of these problems.
Well, I think the thing about the interventions is that, just looking at Syria, it always looks great when a great power comes in and sort of comes in with a great bang. But it's what do you do after that?
Well, you know,
and we
writing,
haven't had anybody do anything after the great bang.
After, in journalism and in writing, we have a lot of cliches. And one of them is every story is either happy or sad depending on where you end it. If we could have ended the story of Iraq right after the mission accomplished announcement by President Bush, everything would have been fine. But history doesn't work that way. So somehow we need to break the hold of this liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat establishment. I heard John McCain, who's very much a member of that establishment, make a critique of those of us who are on the outside, he says on the right, some on the left, and people that don't understand the centrality of American power in the world. So what did he call us? He gave us a great name. He said, they're the wacko birds. I want to be a wacko bird. I think that better than isolationist or anti-imperialist or non-interventionist, that's the T-shirt I want to wear.
I only have a minute for you to answer this, but going around, starting with Steve, what do we do about China and the South China Sea while we're so concentrated on the Middle East?
First of all, I think we have to understand that we cannot prevent China from exercising authority in the South China Sea any more than we would accept China dominating the North Atlantic and sailing around New York and Bermuda. This is a very complex challenge for the United States. We've never faced anything like this, a country that's bigger than us, older than us, soon to be more economically powerful than us, and our friends in that part of the world are begging us to come over militarily and defend them, but they don't want to defend themselves. They want Uncle Sucker to come over and do it. And it's time to realize that the United States is not going to be able to contain China in the Pacific.
The administration took a big step forward with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Its fate in Congress is probably an open question, particularly in the context of a presidential campaign. But this is something that America's allies in the Pacific have been looking for as a signal of American commitment and resolve and seriousness about the relationship.
Well, we don't have to end this on sad or happy.
Or
wacko, because we will be back next week. Meanwhile, you can look us up at whchronicle.com, see programs in this series, and read Linda's writing and mine. And anybody else who wants to write, we'll be happy to accommodate you, Steve. That is our show. Cheers.